she said. Someone make them stop. The next time she woke, Jane was holding a cup of hot soup to her lips. Onion broth, Brian thought. She drank as much of it as she could, until a bit of carrot caught in her throat and made her choke. Coughing was agony.
Easy,
the girl said.
Gendry, she wheezed. I have to talk with Gendry.
He turns back at the river, m'lady. He's gone back to his forge, to Willow, and the little ones to keep them safe.
No one can keep them safe.
She began to cough again.
Ah, let her choke. Save us a rope.
One of the shadow men shoved the girl aside. He was clad in rusted rings and a studded belt. At his hip hung long sword and dirk. A yellow greatcloak was plastered to his shoulders, sodden and filthy. From his shoulders rose a steel dog's head, its teeth bared in a snarl.
No, Brian moaned. No, you're dead. I killed you.
The hound laughed.
You got that backwards. It'll be me killing you. I'd do it now, but my lady wants to see you hanged.
Hanged. The word sent a jolt of fear through her. She looked at the girl, Jane.
She is too young to be so hard.
Bread and salt, Brain gasped. The inn, Septon Meribald, fed the children. We broke bread with your sister.
Guessed right. Don't mean so much as it used to, said the girl. Not since m'lady come back from the wedding. Some of them swinging down by the river figured they was guests too.
We figured different, said the hound. They wanted beds. We gave them trees.
We got more trees, though,
put in another shadow, one-eyed beneath a rusty pot helm.
We always got more trees.
When it was time to mount again, they yanked a leather hood down over her face. There were no eye holes. The leather muffled the sounds around her. The taste of onions lingered on her tongue, sharp as the knowledge of her failure.
They mean to hang me.
She thought of Jaime, of Sansa, of her father back on Tarth, and was glad for the hood. It helped hide the tears welling in her eyes. From time to time she heard the outlaws talking, but she could not make out their words. After a while she gave herself up to weariness and the slow, steady motion of her horse. This time she dreamed that she was home again at evenfall. Through the high-arched windows of her lord father's hall, she could see the sun just going down.
I was safe here. I was safe.
She was dressed in silk brocade, a quartered gown of blue and red decorated with golden suns and silver crescent moons. On another girl it might have been a pretty gown, but not on her. She was 12, ungainly and uncomfortable, waiting to meet the young knight her father had arranged for her to marry, a boy 6 years her senior, sure to be a famous champion one day. She dreaded his arrival. Her bosom was too small, her hands and feet too big, her hair kept sticking up, and there was a pimple nestled in the fold beside her nose. "He will bring a rose for you," her father promised her, but a rose was no good. A rose could not keep her safe. It was a sword she wanted.
"Oathkeeper, I have to find the girl. I have to find his honor."
Finally the doors opened, and her betrothed strode into her father's hall. She tried to greet him, as she had been instructed, only to have blood come pouring from her mouth. She had bitten her tongue off as she waited. She spat it at the young knight's feet and saw the disgust on his face.
"Brian the beauty," he said in a mocking tone. "I have seen sows more beautiful than you."
He tossed the rose in her face. As he walked away, the griffins on his cloak rippled and blurred and changed to lions.
"Jaime," she wanted to cry. "Jaime, come back for me."
But her tongue lay on the floor by the rose, drowned in blood. Brain woke suddenly, gasping. She did not know where she was. The air was cold and heavy and smelled of earth and worms and mould. She was lying on a pallet beneath a mound of sheepskins, with rock above her head and roots poking through the walls. The only light came from a tallow candle smoking in a pool of melted wax. She pushed aside the sheepskins. Someone had stripped her of her clothes and armour, she saw. She was clad in a brown woolen shift, thin but freshly washed. Her forearm had been splintered and bound up with linen, though. One side of her face felt wet and stiff. When she touched herself, she found some sort of damp poultice covering her cheek and jaw and ear.
Bite her. Brain got to her feet. Her legs felt weak as water, her head as light as air. Is anyone there? Something moved in one of the shadowed alcoves behind the candle. An old grey man, clad in rags. The blankets that had covered him slipped to the floor. He sat up and rubbed his eyes. Lady Brain, you gave me a fright. I was dreaming. No, she thought. That was me. What place is this? Is this a dungeon?
A cave. Like rats, we must run back to our holes when the dogs come sniffing after us, and there are more dogs every day.
He was clad in the ragged remains of an old robe, pink and white. His hair was long and grey and tangled. The loose skin of his cheeks and chin was covered with coarse stubble.
Are you hungry? Could you keep down a cup of milk? Perhaps some bread and honey?
I want my clothes. My sword. She felt naked without her mail, and she wanted Oathkeeper at her side. The way out. Show me the way out. The floor of the cave was dirt and stone, rough beneath the soles of her feet. Even now she felt light-headed, as if she were floating. The flickering light cast queer shadows. Spirits of the slain, she thought, dancing all about me, hiding when I turned to look at them. Everywhere she saw holes and cracks and crevices, but there was no way to know which passages led out, which would take her deeper into the cave, and which went nowhere. All were black as pitch.
Might I feel your brow, my lady?
Her jailer's hand was scarred and hard with callous, yet strangely gentle. Your fever has broken, he announced in a voice flavored with the accents of the free cities.
Well and good. Just yesterday your flesh felt as if it were on fire. Jane feared that we might lose you.
Jane, the tall girl,
the very one, though she is not so tall as you, my lady. Long Jane, the men call her. It was she who set your arm and splintered it, as well as any maester. She did what she could for your face as well, washing out the wounds with boiled ale to stop the mortification. Even so, a human bite is a filthy thing. That is where the fever came from, I am certain. The grey man touched her bandaged face. We had to cut away some of the flesh. Your face will not be pretty, I fear.
It has never been pretty.
Scars, you mean? My lady, that creature chewed off half your cheek.
Brain could not help but flinch. Every knight has battle scars, Sir Goodwin had warned her when she asked him to teach her the sword.
Is that what you want, child?
Her old maester-at-arms had been talking about sword cuts, though. He could never have anticipated biters' pointed teeth. Why set my bones and wash my wounds, if you only mean to hang me?
Why, indeed?
He glanced at the candle as if he could no longer bear to look at her. You fought bravely at the inn, they tell me. Lem should not have left the crossroads. He was told to stay close, hidden, to come at once if he saw smoke rising from the chimney. But when word reached him that the mad dog of Saltpans had been seen making his way north along the Green Fork, he took the bait.
We have been hunting that lot for so long.
Still, he ought to have known better. As it was half a day before he realized that the mummers had used a stream to hide their tracks and doubled back behind him, and then he lost more time circling around a column of Frey knights. If not for you, only corpses might have remained at the inn by the time that Lem and his men got back. That was why Jane dressed your wounds, mayhaps. Whatever else you may have done, you won those wounds honorably in the best of causes. Whatever else you may have done.
What is it that you think I've done? She said. Who are you?
We were king's men when we began, the man told her. But king's men must have a king, and we have none. We were brothers too, but now our brotherhood is broken. I do not know who we are, if truth be told, nor where we might be going. I only know the road is dark. The fires have not shown me what lies at its end. I know where it ends. I have seen the corpses in the trees.
Fires,
Brain repeated. All at once she understood.
You are the Mirish priest, the Red Wizard.
He looked down at his ragged robes and smiled ruefully. The Pink Pretender, rather.
I am Thoros, late of Myr, aye, a bad priest and a worse wizard.
You ride with Dondarrion,
the Lightning Lord. Lightning comes and goes, and then is seen no more. So too with men. Lord Beric's fire has gone out of this world, I fear. A grimmer shadow leads us in his place. The Hound. The priest pursed his lips. The Hound is dead and buried.
I saw him in the woods.
A fever dream, my lady.
He said that he would hang me.
Even dreams can lie. My lady, how long has it been since you have eaten? Surely you are famished. She was, she realized. Her belly felt hollow.
Food. Food would be welcome, thank you.
A meal, then. Sit. We will talk more, but first a meal. Wait here.
Thoros lit a taper from the sagging candle and vanished into a black hole beneath a ledge of rock.
Brain found herself alone in the small cave.
For how long, though?
She prowled the chamber, looking for a weapon. Any sort of weapon would have served, a staff, a club, a dagger. She found only rocks. One fit her fist nicely, but she remembered the whispers and what happened when Shagwell tried to pit a stone against a knife. When she heard the priest's returning footsteps, she let the rock fall to the cavern floor and resumed her seat. Thoros had bread and cheese and a bowl of stew.
"I am sorry," he said. "The last of the milk had soured, and the honey is all gone. Food grows scant. Still, this will fill you."
The stew was cold and greasy, the bread hard, the cheese harder. Brain had never eaten anything half so good.
"Are my companions here?"
she asked the priest as she was spooning up the last of the stew.
"The Septon was set free to go upon his way. There was no harm in him. The others are here awaiting judgment."
"Judgment?" she frowned. "Podrick Payne is just a boy."
"He says he is a squire.
You know how boys will boast.
The imp's squire. He has fought in battles by his own admission. He has even killed, to hear him tell it."
"A boy," she said again. "Have pity."
"My lady," Thoros said, "I do not doubt that kindness and mercy and forgiveness can still be found somewhere in these seven kingdoms, but do not look for them here. This is a cave, not a temple. When men must live like rats in the dark, beneath the earth, they soon run out of pity, as they do of milk and honey.
And justice? Can that be found in caves?"
"Justice?" Thoros smiled wanly. "I remember justice. It had a pleasant taste. Justice was what we were about when Beric led us, or so we told ourselves. We were king's men, knights and heroes, but some nights are dark and full of terror, my lady. War makes monsters of us all."
"Are you saying you are monsters?"
"I'm saying we are human. You are not the only one with wounds, Lady Brian. Some of my brothers were good men when this began. Some were less good, shall we say, though there are those who say it does not matter how a man begins, but only how he ends. I suppose it is the same for women." The priest got to his feet. "Our time together is at an end, I fear. I hear my brothers coming. Our lady sends for you." Brain heard their footsteps and saw torchlight flickering in the passage.
"You told me she had gone to Fair Market."
"And so she had. She returned whilst we were sleeping. She never sleeps herself."
"I will not be afraid," she told herself, but it was too late for that. "I will not let them see my fear," she promised herself instead.
There were four of them, hard men with haggard faces, clad in mail and scale and leather. She recognized one of them, the man with one eye from her dreams. The biggest of the four wore a stained and tattered yellow cloak.
"Enjoy the food?" he asked. "I hope so. It's the last food you'd ever like to eat." He was brown-haired, bearded, brawny, with a broken nose that had healed badly.
"I know this man," Brain thought. "You are the Hound."
He grinned. His teeth were awful, crooked and streaked brown with rot. "I suppose I am, seeing as how my lady went and killed the last one." He turned his head and spat.
She remembered lightning flashing, the mud beneath her feet.
It was Rorge I killed. He took the helm from Clegane's grave and you stole it off his corpse. I didn't hear him objecting.
Thoros sucked in his breath in dismay.
Is this true? A dead man's helm? Have we fallen that low?
The big man scowled at him.
It's good steel. There is nothing good about that helm nor the men who wore it, said the Red Priest.
Sandor Clegane was a man in torment, and Rorge a beast in human skin.
I'm not them.
Then why show the world their face, savage, snarling, twisted?
Is that who you would be, Lem?
The sight of it will make my foes afraid. The sight of it makes me afraid.
Close your eyes, then.
The man in the yellow cloak made a sharp gesture.
Bring the whore.
Brienne did not resist. There were four of them, and she was weak and wounded, naked beneath the woolen shift. She had to bend her neck to keep from hitting her head as they marched her through the twisting passage. The way ahead rose sharply, turning twice before emerging in a much larger cavern full of outlaws. A fire pit had been dug into the center of the floor, and the air was blue with smoke. Men clustered near the flames, warming themselves against the chill of the cave. Others stood along the walls or sat cross-legged on straw pallets. There were women, too, and even a few children peering out from behind their mother's skirts. The one face Brienne knew belonged to Long Jane Heddle. A trestle table had been set up across the cave in a cleft in the rock. Behind it sat a woman all in grey, cloaked and hooded. In her hands was a crown, a bronze circlet ringed by iron swords. She was studying it, her fingers stroking the blades as if to test their sharpness. Her eyes glimmered under her hood. Grey was the colour of the Silent Sisters, the handmaidens of the stranger. Brienne felt a shiver climb her spine. Stoneheart.
"M'lady," said the big man.
"Here she is."
"Aye," added the one-eyed man. "The Kingslayer's whore."
She flinched. "Why would you call me that?"
"If I had a silver stag for every time you said his name, I'd be as rich as your friends the Lannisters."
"That was only... You do not understand."
"Don't we, though?" The big man laughed. "I think we might. There's a stink of lion about you, lady."
"That's not so." Another of the outlaws stepped forward, a younger man in a greasy sheepskin jerkin. In his hand was Oathkeeper.
"This says it is."
His voice was frosted with the accents of the north. He slid the sword from its scabbard and placed it in front of Lady Stoneheart. In the light from the fire pit, the red and black ripples in the blade almost seemed to move. But the woman in grey had eyes only for the pommel, a golden lion's head with ruby eyes that shone like two red stars.
"There is this as well."
Thoros of Myr drew a parchment from his sleeve and put it down next to the sword.
"It bears the boy king's seal and says the bearer is about his business."
Lady Stoneheart set the sword aside to read the letter.
"The sword was given me for a good purpose," said Brienne. "Sir Jaime swore an oath to Catelyn Stark."
"Before his friends cut her throat for her, that must have been," said the big man in the yellow cloak. "We all know about the Kingslayer and his oaths."
"It is no good," Brienne realized. "No words of mine will sway them."
She plunged ahead despite that.
"He promised Lady Catelyn her daughters, but by the time we reached King's Landing, they were gone. Jaime sent me out to seek the Lady Sansa."
"And if you had found the girl," asked the young Northman, "what were you to do with her?"
"Protect her. Take her somewhere safe."
The big man laughed.
"Where's that? CSA's dungeon?"
"No."
"Deny it all you want. That sword says you're a liar. Are we supposed to believe the Lannisters are handing out gold and ruby swords to foes? That the Kingslayer meant for you to hide the girl from his own twin? I suppose the paper with the boy King's seal was just in case you needed to wipe your ass? And then there's the company you keep."
The big man turned and beckoned. The ranks of outlaws parted, and two more captives were brought forth.
"The boy was the imp's own squire, my lady," he said to Lady Stoneheart. T'other is one of Randall Bloody Tarly's bloody household knights.
Heil Hunt had been beaten so badly that his face was swollen almost beyond recognition. As they shoved him, he stumbled and almost fell. Podrick caught him by the arm.
Sir,
the boy said miserably when he saw Brian.
Sorry.
You have nothing to be sorry for. Brian turned to Lady Stoneheart. Whatever treachery you think I may have done, my lady, Podrick and Sir Heil were no part of it.
They're lions, said the one-eyed man. That's enough. I say they hang. Tarly's hanged a score of ours. Past time we strung up some of his.
Sir Heil gave Brian a faint smile.
My lady, he said, you should have wed me when I made my offer. Now I fear you're doomed to die a maid, and me a poor man.
Let them go, Brian pleaded. The woman in grey gave no answer. She studied the sword, the parchment, the bronze and iron crown. Finally, she reached up under her jaw and grasped her neck as if she meant to throttle herself. Instead, she spoke. Her voice was halting, broken, tortured. The sound seemed to come from her throat, part croak, part wheeze, part death rattle. The language of the damned, thought Brian. I don't understand. What did she say?
She asked the name of this blade of yours, said the young Northman in the sheepskin jerkin.
Oathkeeper,
Brian answered. The woman in grey hissed through her fingers. Her eyes were two red pits burning in the shadows. She spoke again. No, she says. Call it Oathbreaker, she says. It was made for treachery and murder. She names it False Friend. Like you.
To whom have I been false?
To her, the Northman said. Can it be that my lady has forgotten that you once swore her your service? There was only one woman that the Maid of Tarth had ever sworn to serve.
That cannot be, she said. She's dead.
Death and guest right, muttered Long Jane Heddle. They don't mean so much as they used to, neither one.
Lady Stoneheart lowered her hood and unwound the grey wool scarf from her face. Her hair was dry and brittle, white as bone. Her brow was mottled green and grey, spotted with the brown blooms of decay. The flesh of her face clung in ragged strips from her eyes down to her jaw. Some of the rips were crusted with dried blood, but others gaped open to reveal the skull beneath.
Her face, Brian thought. Her face was so strong and handsome, her skin so smooth and soft.
Lady Catelyn.
Tears filled her eyes.
They said that you were dead.
She is, said Thoros of Myr. The phrase slashed her throat from ear to ear. When we found her by the river, she was 3 days dead. Harwin begged me to give her the kiss of life, but it had been too long. I would not do it. So Lord Beric put his lips to hers instead, and the flame of life passed from him to her, and she rose. May the Lord of Light protect us. She rose.
Am I dreaming still?
Brian wondered.
Is this another nightmare, born from Biter's teeth?
I never betrayed her. Tell her that. I swear it by the Seven. I swear it by my sword. The thing that had been Catelyn Stark took hold of her throat again, fingers pinching at the ghastly long slash in her neck, and choked out more sounds.
Words are wind, she says, the Northman told Brian. She says that you must prove your faith.
How?
Asked Brian.
With your sword.
Oathkeeper, you call it. Then keep your oath to her, m'lady says.
What does she want of me?
She wants her son alive, or the men who killed him dead, said the big man. She wants to feed the crows, like they did at the Red Wedding. Freys and Boltons, aye. We'll give her those, as many as she likes. All she asks from you is Jaime Lannister.
Jaime.
The name was a knife, twisting in her belly.
Lady Catelyn, you do not understand, Jaime. He saved me from being raped when the bloody mummers took us. And later he came back for me. He leapt into the bear pit, empty-handed. I swear to you, he is not the man he was. He sent me after Sansa to keep her safe, so he could not have had a part in the Red Wedding.
Lady Catelyn's fingers dug deep into her throat, and the words came rattling out, choked and broken, a stream as cold as ice. The Northman said, "She says that you must choose. Take the sword and slay the Kingslayer, or be hanged for a betrayer. The sword or the noose," she says. "Choose," she says. "Choose." Brienne remembered her dream, waiting in her father's hall for the boy she was to marry. In the dream she had bitten off her tongue. My mouth was full of blood. She took a ragged breath and said, "I will not make that choice." There was a long silence. Then Lady Stoneheart spoke again. This time, Brienne understood her words. There were only two.
"Hang them," she croaked. "As you command, m'lady," said the big man.
They bound Brienne's wrists with rope again and led her from the cavern, up a twisting stony path to the surface. It was morning outside, she was surprised to see. Shafts of pale dawn light were slanting through the trees. "So many trees to choose from," she thought. "They will not need to take us far." Nor did they. Beneath a crooked willow, the outlaw slipped the noose about her neck, jerked it tight, and tossed the other end of the rope over a limb. Hyle Hunt and Podrick Payne were given elms. Sir Hyle was shouting that he would kill Jaime Lannister, but the hound cuffed him across the face and shut him up. He had donned the helm again. "If you got crimes to confess to your gods, this would be the time to say them."
"Podrick has never harmed you. My father will ransom him. Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle. Send Podrick with my bones to Evenfall, and you'll have sapphire, silver, whatever you want."
"I want my wife and daughter back," said the hound. "Can your father give me that?
If not, he can get buggered. The boy will rot beside you. Wolves will gnaw your bones."
"Do you mean to hang her, Lem?" asked the one-eyed man. "Or do you figure to talk the bitch to death?"
The hound snatched the end of the rope from the man holding it.
"Let's see if she can dance," he said,
and gave a yank. Brienne felt the hemp constricting, digging into her skin, jerking her chin upward. Sir Hyle was cursing them eloquently, but not the boy. Podrick never lifted his eyes, not even when his feet were jerked up off the ground.
"If this is another dream, it is time for me to awaken. If this is real, it is time for me to die."
All she could see was Podrick, the noose around his thin neck, his legs twitching. Her mouth opened. Pod was kicking, choking, dying. Brienne sucked the air in desperately, even as the rope was strangling her. Nothing had ever hurt so much. She screamed a word.
Daenerys. Her Dothraki scouts had told her how it was, but Dany wanted to see for herself. Sir Jorah Mormont rode with her through a birchwood forest and up a slanting sandstone ridge. "Near enough," he warned her at the crest. Dany reined in her mare and looked across the fields to where the Yunkish host lay athwart her path. Whitebeard had been teaching her how best to count the numbers of a foe. 5,000, she said after a moment. "I'd say so," Sir Jorah pointed. "Those are sellswords on the flanks, lancers and mounted bowmen with swords and axes for the close work. The second sons on the left wing, the storm crows on the right, about 500 men apiece. See the banners?" Yunkai's harpy grasped a whip, an iron colour, in her talons instead of a length of chain, but the sellswords flew their own standards beneath those of the city they served. On the right, 4 crows between crossed thunderbolts. On the left, a broken sword. "The Yunkai hold the centre themselves," Dany noted. Their officers looked indistinguishable from Astapors at a distance. Tall, bright helms and cloaks sewn with flashing copper discs. "Are those slave soldiers they lead?" "In the large part, but not the equal of Unsullied. Yunkai is known for training bed slaves, not warriors." "What's their you?" Can we defeat this army?
Easily, Ser Jorah said, but not bloodlessly. Blood aplenty had soaked into the bricks of Astapor the day that city fell, though little of it belonged to her or hers. We might win a battle here, but at such cost we cannot take the city. That is a risk, Khaleesi. Astapor was complacent and vulnerable. Yunkai is forewarned.
Danny considered. The slaver host seemed small compared to her own numbers, but the cell swords were a horse. She'd ridden too long with Dothraki not to have a healthy respect for what mounted warriors could do to foot. The Unsullied could withstand their charge, but my freedmen will be slaughtered. The slavers like to talk, she said. Send word that I will hear them this evening in my tent, and invite the captains of the sellsword companies to call on me as well, but not together. The storm crows at midday, the second sun's 2 hours later.
As you wish, Ser Jorah said. But if they do not come,
they'll come. They will be curious to see the dragons and hear what I might have to say, and the clever ones will see it for a chance to gauge my strength. She wheeled her silver mare about. I'll await them in my pavilion. Slate skies and brisk winds saw Danny back to her host. The deep ditch that would encircle her camp was already half dug, and the woods were full of Unsullied, lopping branches off birch trees to sharpen into stakes. The eunuchs could not sleep in an unfortified camp, or so Grey Worm insisted. He was there, watching the work. Danny halted a moment to speak with him. Yunkai has girded up her loins for battle.
This is good, Your Grace. These ones thirst for blood.
When she had commanded the Unsullied to choose officers from amongst themselves, Grey Worm had been their overwhelming choice for the highest rank. Danny had put Ser Jorah over him to train him for command, and the exile knight said that so far the young eunuch was hard but fair, quick to learn, tireless, and utterly unrelenting in his attention to detail. The wise masters have assembled a slave army to meet us.
A slave in Yunkai learns the way of 7 sighs and the 16 seats of pleasure, Your Grace. The Unsullied learn the way of the 3 spears. Your Grey Worm hopes to show you.
One of the first things Danny had done after the fall of Astapor was abolish the custom of giving the Unsullied new slave names every day. Most of those born free had returned to their birth names, those who still remembered them at least. Others had called themselves after heroes or gods, and sometimes weapons, gems, and even flowers, which resulted in soldiers with some very peculiar names to Danny's ears. Grey Worm had remained Grey Worm. When she asked him why, he said,
"It is a lucky name. The name this one was born to was accursed. That was the name he had when he was taken for a slave. But Grey Worm is the name this one drew the day Daenerys Stormborn set him free."
"If battle is joined, let Grey Worm show wisdom as well as valor," Danny told him. "Spare any slave who runs or throws down his weapon. The fewer slain, the more remain to join us after."
"This one will remember."
"I know he will. Be at my tent by midday. I want you there with my other officers when I treat with the sellsword captains." Danny spurred her silver onto camp. Within the perimeter the Unsullied had established, the tents were going up in orderly rows with her own tall golden pavilion at the center. A second encampment lay close beyond her own, 5 times the size, sprawling and chaotic. This second camp had no ditches, no tents, no sentries, no horse lines. Those who had horses or mules slept beside them, for fear they might be stolen. Goats, sheep, and half-starved dogs wandered freely amongst hordes of women, children, and old men. Danny had left Astapor in the hands of a council of former slaves led by a healer, a scholar, and a priest. Wise men all, she thought, and just. Yet even so, tens of thousands preferred to follow her to Yunkai
rather than remain behind in Astapor. I gave them the city, and most of them were too frightened to take it. The raggle-taggle host of freedmen dwarfed her own, but they were more burden than benefit. Perhaps 1 in 100 had a donkey, a camel, or an ox. Most carried weapons looted from some slaver's armory, but only 1 in 10 was strong enough to fight, and none was trained. They ate the land bare as they passed, like locusts in sandals. Yet Danae could not bring herself to abandon them, as Ser Jorah and her blood riders urged. I told them they were free. I cannot tell them now they are not free to join me. She gazed at the smoke rising from their cook fires and swallowed a sigh. She might have the best foot soldiers in the world, but she also had the worst. Arston Whitebeard stood outside the entrance of her tent, while Strong Belwas sat cross-legged on the grass nearby, eating a bowl of figs. On the march, the duty of guarding her fell upon their shoulders. She had made Jogo, Ego, and Ricaro her co's as well as her blood riders, and just now she needed them more to command her Dothraki than to protect her person. Her Khalasar was tiny, some 30-odd mounted warriors, and most of them braidless boys and bent-back old men. Yet they were all the horse she had, and she dared not go without them. The Unsullied might be the finest infantry in all the world, as Ser Jorah claimed, but she needed scouts and outriders as well. Yunkai will have war, Danny told Whitebeard inside the pavilion. Iri and Jiqui had covered the floor with carpets, while Missandei lit a stick of incense to sweeten the dusty air. Drogon and Rhaegal were asleep atop some cushions, curled about each other, but Viserion perched on the edge of her empty bath. Missandei, what language will these Yankai speak? Valyrian?
Yes, your grace, the child said. A different dialect than Astapor's, yet close enough to understand. The slavers name themselves the Wise Masters.
Wise? Danny sat cross-legged on a cushion, and Viserion spread his white and gold wings and flapped to her side. We shall see how wise they are, she said, as she scratched the dragon's scaly head behind the horns. Ser Jorah Mormont returned an hour later, accompanied by 3 captains of the Stormcrows. They wore black feathers on their polished helms and claimed to be all equal in honor and authority. Danny studied them as Eri and Jiqui poured the wine. Prendal na Gazin was a thick-set Giscari, with a broad face and dark hair going grey. Sala the Bald had a twisting scar across his pale carthine cheek, and Dario Naharis was flamboyant even for a Tairoshi. His beard was cut into 3 prongs and dyed blue, the same colour as his eyes, and the curly hair that fell to his collar. His pointed mustachios were painted gold. His clothes were all shades of yellow. A foam of Moorish lace, the colour of butter, spilled from his collar and cuffs. His doublet was sewn with brass medallions in the shape of dandelions, and ornamental goldwork crawled up his high leather boots to his thighs. Gloves of soft yellow suede were tucked into a belt of gilded rings, and his fingernails were enamelled blue. But it was Prendal na Gazin who spoke for the sellswords.
"You would do well to take your rabble elsewhere," he said. "You took Astapor by treachery, but Yankai shall not fall so easily."
500 of your Stormcrows against 10,000 of my Unsullied," said Danny. "I'm only a young girl and do not understand the ways of war, yet these odds seem poor to me."
"The Stormcrows do not stand alone," said Prendal.
"Stormcrows do not stand at all. They fly at the first sign of thunder. Perhaps you should be flying now. I've heard that sellswords are notoriously unfaithful. What will it avail you to be staunch when the second sons change sides?"
"That will not happen," Prendal insisted, unmoved. "And if it did, it would not matter. The second sons are nothing. We fight beside the stalwart men of Yankai.
You fight beside bed boys, armed with spears. When she turned her head, the twin bells in her braid rang softly. Once battle is joined, do not think to ask for quarter. Join me now, however, and you shall keep the gold the Yankai paid you, and claim a share of the plunder besides, with greater rewards later, when I come into my kingdom. Fight for the wise masters, and your wages will be death. Do you imagine the Yankai will open its gates when my unsullied are butchering you beneath the walls?
Woman, you bray like an ass and make no more sense.
Woman, she chuckled. Is that meant to insult me? I would return the slap if I took you for a man. Danny met his stare. I am Daenerys Stormborn of House Targaryen, the Unburnt, Mother of Dragons, Khaleesi to Drogo's Riders, and Queen of the Seven Kingdoms of Westeros.
What you are, said Prendel Nargazin, is a horse lord's whore. When we break you, I will breed you to my stallion.
Strong Belwas drew his arrack.
Strong Belwas will give his ugly tongue to the little queen if she likes.
No, Belwas, I have given these men my safe conduct, she smiled. Tell me this, are the Stormcrows slave or free? We are a brotherhood of free men, Salor declared. Good, Danny stood. Go back and tell your brothers what I said, then. It may be that some of them would sooner sup on gold and glory than on death. I shall want your answer on the morrow. The Stormcrow captains rose in unison.
Our answer is no, said Prendel Nargazin.
His fellows followed him out of the tent, but Dario Naharis glanced back as he left and inclined his head in polite farewell. 2 hours later, the commander of the Second Sons arrived alone. He proved to be a towering bravosi, with pale green eyes and a bushy red-gold beard that reached nearly to his belt. His name was Mero, but he called himself the Titan's Bastard. Mero tossed down his wine straight away, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and leered at Danny.
I believe I've fucked your twin sister in a pleasure house back home. Or was it you?
I think not. I would have remembered a man of such magnificence, I have no doubt.
Yes, that is so. No woman has ever forgotten the Titan's Bastard.
The bravosi held out his cup to Jiqui.
What say you take those clothes off and come and sit on my lap? If you please me, I might bring the Second Sons over to your side.
If you bring the Second Sons over to my side, I might not have you gelded. The big man laughed.
Little girl, another woman once tried to geld me with her teeth. She has no teeth now, but my sword is as long and thick as ever. Shall I take it out and show you?
No need. After my eunuchs cut it off, I can examine it at my leisure. Danny took a sip of wine. It is true that I am only a young girl and do not know the ways of war.
Explain to me how you propose to defeat 10,000 unsullied with your 500.
Innocent as I am, these odds seem poor to me.
The Second Sons have faced worse odds and won.
The Second Sons have faced worse odds and run. At Kohor, when the 3,000 made their stand. Or do you deny it?
That was many and more years ago, before the Second Sons were led by the Titan's Bastard.
So it is from you they get their courage. Danny turned to Ser Jorah. When the battle is joined, kill this one first. The exile knight smiled.
Gladly, your grace.
Of course, she said to Mira, you could run again. We will not stop you. Take your Yunkish gold and go.
Had you ever seen the Titan of Braavos, foolish girl, you would know that it has no tail to turn.
Then stay and fight for me.
You're worth fighting for, it is true, the bravosi said, and I would gladly let you kiss my sword, if I were free, but I've taken Yunkai's coin, and pledge my holy word.
Coins can be returned, she said. I will pay you as much and more. I have other cities to conquer, and a whole kingdom awaiting me half a world away. Serve me faithfully, and the second sons need never seek higher again. The brave Ossie tugged at his thick red beard.
As much and more, and perhaps a kiss besides, eh? Or more than a kiss, for a man as magnificent as me.
Perhaps.
I will like the taste of your tongue, I think.
She could sense Sir Jorah's anger. My black bear does not like this talk of kissing. Think on what I've said tonight. Can I have your answer on the morrow?
You can. The Titan's bastard grinned. Can I have a flagon of this fine wine to take back to my captains?
You may have a ton. It is from the cellars of the good masters of Astapor, and I have wagons full of it.
Then give me a wagon, a token of your good regard.
You have a big thirst.
I'm big all over, and I have many brothers. The Titan's bastard does not drink alone, Khaleesi.
A wagon it is, if you promise to drink to my health.
Done, he boomed, and done, and done. Three toasts will drink you, and bring you an answer when the sun comes up.
But when Miro was gone, Austin Whitebeard said,
That man has an evil reputation, even in Westeros. Do not be misled by his manner, your grace. He will drink three toasts your health tonight and rape you on the morrow.
The old man's right for once, Sir Jorah said. The second sons are an old company, and not without valour, but under Miro they turn near as bad as the brave companions. The man is as dangerous to his employers as to his foes. That's why you'll find him out here. None of the free cities will hire him any longer.
It is not his reputation that I want. It's his 500 horse. What of the Stormcrows? Is there any hope there?
No, Sir Jorah said bluntly. That Prendal is Giscari by blood. Likely he had kin in Astapor.
A pity. Well, perhaps we will not need to fight. Let us wait and hear what the Yunkai have to say. The envoys from Yunkai arrived as the sun was going down. 50 men on magnificent black horses and one on a great white camel. Their helms were twice as tall as their heads, so as not to crush the bizarre twists and towers and shapes of their oiled hair beneath. They dyed their linen skirts and tunics a deep yellow and sewed copper discs to their cloaks. The man on the white camel named himself Grasdan Mo Eras, lean and hard. He had a white smile, such as Krasny's had worn until Drogon burned off his face. His hair was drawn up in a unicorn's horn that jutted from his brow, and his tokar was fringed with golden Moorish lace.
"Ancient and glorious is Yunkai, the queen of cities," he said when Danny welcomed him to her tent. "Our walls are strong, our nobles proud and fierce, our common folk without fear. Ours is the blood of ancient Gis, whose empire was old when Valyria was yet a squalling child. You were wise to sit and speak, Khaleesi. You shall find no easy conquest here."
"Good. My Unsullied will relish a bit of a fight." She looked to Grey Worm, who nodded. Grasdan shrugged expansively.
"If blood is what you wish, let it flow. I am told you have freed your eunuchs. Freedom means as much to an Unsullied as a hat to a haddock."
He smiled at Grey Worm, but the eunuch might have been made of stone.
"Those who survive, we shall enslave again and use to retake Astapor from the rabble. We can make a slave of you as well, do not doubt it. There are pleasure houses in Lys and Tyrosh where men would pay handsomely to bed the last Targaryen."
"It is good to see you know who I am,"
said Danny mildly.
I pride myself on my knowledge of the savage, senseless West.
Grasdan spread his hands, a gesture of conciliation.
And yet, why should we speak thus harshly to one another? It is true that you committed savageries in Astapor, but we Yankai are a most forgiving people. Your quarrel is not with us, Your Grace. Why squander your strength against our mighty walls when you will need every man to regain your father's throne in Far Westeros? Yankai wishes you only well in that endeavor, and to prove the truth of that, I have brought you a gift.
He clapped his hands, and two of his escorts came forward, bearing a heavy cedar chest, bound in bronze and gold. They set it at her feet.
50,000 golden marks,
Grasdan said smoothly.
Yours, as a gesture of friendship from the wise masters of Yankai. Gold given freely is better than plunder bought with blood, surely. So I say to you, Daenerys Targaryen, take this chest and go.
Danny pushed open the lid of the chest with a small, slippered foot. It was full of gold coins, just as the envoy said. She grabbed a handful and let them run through her fingers. They shone brightly as they tumbled and fell, new minted, most of them, stamped with a stepped pyramid on one face and the harpy of Gis on the other. Very pretty. I wonder how many chests like this I shall find when I take your city. He chuckled.
None, for that you shall never do.
I have a gift for you as well. She slammed the chest shut. 3 days. On the morning of the 3rd day, send out your slaves, all of them. Every man, woman, and child shall be given a weapon, and as much food, clothing, coin, and goods as he or she can carry. These they shall be allowed to choose freely from amongst their master's possessions, as payment for their years of servitude. When all the slaves have departed, you will open your gates and allow my unsullied to enter and search your city, to make certain none remain in bondage. If you do this, Yankai will not be burned or plundered, and none of your people shall be molested. The wise masters will have the peace they desire, and will have proved themselves wise indeed. What say you?
I say you are mad.
Am I? Danny shrugged, and said, Dracarys. The dragons answered. Rhaegal hissed and smoked. Viserion snapped, and Drogon spat swirling red-black flame. It touched the drape of Grasdan's tokar and the silk court in half a heartbeat. Golden marks spilled across the carpets as the envoy stumbled over the chest, shouting curses and beating at his arm until Whitebeard flung a flagon of water over him to douse the flames.
You swore I should have safe conduct,
the Yunkish envoy wailed. Do all the Yunkai whine so over a singed tokar? I shall buy you a new one, if you deliver up your slaves within 3 days. Elsewise, Drogon shall give you a warmer kiss. She wrinkled her nose. You've soiled yourself. Take your gold and go, and see that the wise masters hear my message. Grasdan Mor Eras pointed a finger.
You shall rule this arrogance whore. These little lizards will not keep you safe, I promise you. We will fill the air with arrows if they come within a league of Yankai. Do you think it's so hard to kill a dragon?
Harder than to kill a slaver. 3 days, Grasdan. Tell them. By the end of the 3rd day, I will be in Yankai, whether you open your gates for me or no. Full dark had fallen by the time the Yunkai departed from her camp. It promised to be a gloomy night,
moonless, starless, with a chill wet wind blowing from the west. A fine black night, thought Danny. The fires burned all around her, small orange stars strewn across hill and field. "Sir Jorah," she said, "summon my blood riders." Danny seated herself on a mound of cushions to await them, her dragons all about her. When they were assembled, she said, "An hour past midnight should be time enough."
"Yes, Khaleesi," said Ricaru. "Time for what?"
"To mount our attack." Sir Jorah Mormont scowled. "You told the sellswords?" "That I wanted their answers on the morrow. I made no promises about tonight. The Stormcrows will be arguing about my offer. The Second Sons will be drunk on the wine I gave Miro, and the Yunkai believe they have 3 days. We will take them under cover of this darkness."
"They will have scouts watching for us."
"And in the dark, they will see hundreds of campfires burning," said Danny, "if they see anything at all."
"Khaleesi," said Jogo, "I will deal with these scouts. They are no riders, only slavers on horses."
"Just so," she agreed. "I think we should attack from 3 sides. Grey Worm, your unsullied shall strike at them from right and left, while my coes lead my horse in wedge for a thrust through their centre." "Slave soldiers will never stand before mounted Dothraki," she smiled. "To be sure, I am only a young girl and know little of war. What do you think, my lords?"
"I think you are Rhaegar Targaryen's sister," Sir Jorah said with a rueful half-smile.
"Aye," said Arston Whitebeard, "and a queen as well."
It took an hour to work out all the details. "Now begins the most dangerous time," Danny thought as her captains departed to their commands. She could only pray that the gloom of the night would hide her preparations from the foe. Near midnight, she got a scare when Sir Jorah bulled his way past Strong Belwas.
"The Unsullied caught one of the sellswords trying to sneak into the camp."
"A spy?" That frightened her. If they caught one, how many others might have gotten away?
"He claims to come bearing gifts. It's the yellow fool with the blue hair."
"Dario Naharis." "That one. I'll hear him then." When the exile knight delivered him, she asked herself whether 2 men had ever been so different. The Tyroshi was fair, where Sir Jorah was swarthy, lithe, where the knight was brawny, graced with flowing locks, while the other was balding, yet smooth-skinned, where Mormont was hairy, and her knight dressed plainly, while this other made a peacock look drab, though he had thrown a heavy black cloak over his bright yellow finery for this visit. He carried a heavy canvas sack slung over one shoulder.
"Khaleesi," he cried, "I bring gifts and glad tidings. The Stormcrows are yours."
A golden tooth gleamed in his mouth when he smiled.
"And so is Dario Naharis."
Danny was dubious. If this Tyroshi had come to spy, this declaration might be no more than a desperate plot to save his head. "What do Prendel Na Gazin and Salor say of this?"
"Little."
Dario upended the sack, and the heads of Salor the Bald and Prendel Na Gazin spilled out upon her carpets.
"My gifts to the Dragon Queen."
Viserion sniffed the blood leaking from Prendel's neck and let loose a gout of flame that took the dead man full in the face, blackening and blistering his bloodless cheeks. Drogon and Rhaegar stirred at the smell of roasted meat.
"You did this?" Danny asked queasily.
"None other."
If her dragons discomfited Dario Naharis, he hid it well. For all the mind he paid them, they might have been 3 kittens playing with a mouse.
"Why?"
"Because you are so beautiful."
His hands were large and strong, and there was something in his hard blue eyes and great curving nose that suggested the fierceness of some splendid bird of prey.
Prendel talked too much and said too little.
His garb, rich as it was,